Hello and welcome to NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service with me, Rebecca Kesby. And first today, in a televised address, President Zelensky has told Ukrainians not to be overly alarmed by the situation on the border with Russia. He said there are no rose-coloured glasses, no childish illusions, everything is not simple, but there is hope. He went on to say, protect your bodies from viruses, your brain from lies, and your heart from panic. So is he trying to calm the nerves of the Ukrainian people or those of the 100,000 Russian troops stationed on the border? Today, representatives from Ukraine, Russia, Germany and France are meeting in Paris to discuss the crisis. Can those talks do anything to de-escalate the tensions? Earlier, I spoke to David Stern, Kiev correspondent for The Washington Post. He gave me his assessment of the mood in Kiev.
Well, it's difficult. Obviously, this is, you know, Kiev's a city of around 3 million and what Ukraine's a country of about 40 million. I guess you could say there's a variety of moods. One of them is just, you know, going on with life as usual and people sort of taking it in, either filing it away and or completely ignoring it. But there is tension. You know, among our, I've lived in Ukraine for about 11 years now, and we have, my wife and I have friends here, and people are asking me, you know, what I think is going to happen. There is discussions, some fairly well advanced, some just starting, about what to do in, you know, in the situation that there are troops coming over the border and what that means and what the possibilities are. But I'd also say that, you know, Ukraine has been, this is what now, 8 years that we've been in a state of war. And so it's a funny situation when you live in a country that has war on its actual territory, and people tend to be kind of not fatalistic, but they just go about their business because they can expect the worst at any moment.
We know that delegations are meeting in Paris today to try and look at this Normandy idea of President Macron, France and Germany, Russia and Ukraine. Are there hopes that something may come out of that? And if so, what?
If so, what is a big question. We'll see about that one, what they're actually discussing. Definitely there are hopes. And there have been at least initially positive noises. Andrei Yermak, who's one of President Zelensky's main advisors, he's at the talks, and he tweeted just before that they'd agreed on the format, which he said was a strong signal of readiness for a peaceful settlement.
And what can you tell us about the political unity within Ukraine? In a moment, we're going to be hearing from the former president, Petro Poroshenko, on the programme. He's accused of state treason and is facing a court case at the moment. He says all of this is politically motivated, but he does still have quite a lot of supporters. And that is some sort of a distraction, isn't it, at the moment in Ukraine?
Yes, yes. He's being investigated for state treason and supporting terrorism. I guess the short answer to that is that Ukraine is a democracy and sometimes a very chaotic one. It's difficult to say. I'm not going to, you know, comment on, you know, whether this is the merits of the case. It has been a bit of a distraction for some people. It has been an incredible scene that his U.S. representatives, senators, were in Kiev just sort of dozens of yards away from them was the actual court hearing that was deciding whether or not to place Mr. Poroshenko into custody pending during his investigation and possibly the trial. It's difficult to say exactly where this is coming from, but it is anytime you have something like this, it does risk dividing the country, and that's what some analysts and observers have warned, that this is not the right time for it.
David Stern there, Kiev correspondent for The Washington Post. And as I mentioned there earlier, we did speak to former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, who came to power in 2014 after the Ukrainian Revolution, but who was then beaten by Mr. Zelensky in a landslide victory in 2019. As we were hearing, Mr. Poroshenko now faces several investigations, charges of corruption, and a legal case against him of state treason. I began by asking him about those charges, and he gave me his response.
Unfortunately, we all 3 years, Mr. Zelensky demonstrated the politically motivated prosecution and selective justice, and everybody knows that. And this is, can you imagine, about 120 cases they launch against me. First of all, for example, as a phone conversation with the then Vice President Biden, that was also qualified as Mr. Zelensky as a high treason. Signing up Minsk agreement was also qualified as a state treason. My order as a commander-in-chief of Ukrainian armed forces for counterattack Russian troops in the year 2014 was a high treason. So unfortunately, this is a continuation more during these 3 years, and no Ukrainian, no public activists, no politician, no foreign diplomats has unfortunately any different qualification as a pressure on me as a leader of Ukrainian opposition. And now strengthening the pressure is connected that my political party and me as a political leader is under all opinion poll demonstrated that we are the leader in opinion poll. And that unfortunately make Mr. Zelensky nervous. I make kind of a very responsibly stating that the name which General Prosecutor named Mr. Rabashapka, that this is absolutely legal trash. And I can only add that this is the fake, this is the groundless, and which is very important that this is the gift to Putin, because all the foreign leaders said that it is impossible to find out the worst time for launching these things when Ukraine facing the Russian aggression need to demonstrate the unity, because only strong and united Ukraine can defeat the Russian aggression.
I mean, of course, Mr. Zelensky did come to power in 2019 with a landslide, so whether he would feel the need for a government of national unity is another question. But let's move on to the situation on the border with Russia, very serious for your country. This is something you've got experience of. You came to power in 2014. You had to deal with the annexation of Crimea by Russia, the war in eastern Ukraine, of course. How do you view this situation as it is now, and what differs from 8 years ago?
First of all, you are absolutely right. This is not now we have an invasion, aggression of Russia. We have this aggression almost 8 years. Exactly on the 20th of February, in less than 1 month, we would be 8 years of the Russian aggression. And that's launching in Crimea when Putin not recognized Russian presence there, making the fake information about the direct Russian involvement in the Crimea, and then the same thing is happening on the east of our country. And with this situation, I think that this is a great achievement of Ukrainian, of all my team, that we saved the country in the year 2014-2015, because the plan of Putin was disintegrated Ukraine. He officially named that was a plan of creating Novorossiya or Malorossiya, taking 9 from 25 regions of Ukraine as a separate state. We stopped Putin aggression. And I'm proud that me as a commander-in-chief released 2/3 of the occupied Donbas and returned control of Ukraine to this land.
Okay, but what about the current situation now is very different again, isn't it? The whole world has changed in the past 8 years, and this is a new threat now to Ukraine. Or is it? Do you think President Putin is serious?
I think, first of all, President Putin is absolutely serious. And the understanding of the world is different, because if beforehand everybody in the world understand that this is the danger for Ukraine, now nobody has any illusion that this is the danger for the European and global security, because Putin can at the same time attack to the Baltic states, attack to the Poland, using Ukraine as an instrument for blackmailing the whole world. And with this situation, everybody understand that investing in Ukrainian security, they invest to the their own security. And I have one proposal to all the viewers and listeners of BBC and to all the leaders. Don't be afraid to surprise Putin. Surprise by our unity, surprise by our strength. And Putin now is just simply rise the stakes. He blackmailing the world. And with this situation, definitely united and strong Ukraine is absolutely right answer to Putin. And if you ask me what now Ukraine need from the West, point number one is that we need to increase the defensive capabilities of Ukraine. We should make Russia weaker, weaker by introducing sanctions, weaker by presenting the hell sanction if he make a decision to continuation in aggression. We should present to Ukraine membership action plan, because that is right answer for the blackmail of Putin, not only to Ukraine, but to the whole world. No concession to Russia. This is the part of the things we need.
Your language there, talking about wanting to make Russia weaker, talking about arming Ukraine. I mean, this is the sort of language that President Putin finds so offensive. And those in Russia are saying that Ukraine actually could be the aggressor here. They're the ones building up military hardware and talking about wanting to join the EU and NATO. I mean, a lot of people in Russia would say that he's got a point.
Please don't stay on the Russian narrative. Because Ukraine is just need the defensive weapons. We don't demonstrate any tiny reason for provocation. In all these years, we have, especially in 2014, 2015, we have an artillery and rocket fire from the Russian territory. They killing my soldiers, they killing Ukrainians. And with this situation, the whole world see that. And what is the dream of Putin is just to recreate the Russian Empire, recreate the Soviet Union 2.0. And I think that now Ukraine, you should understand that, is the last puzzle in the whole Putin's map. And this situation is extremely dangerous. And this is the sovereign right of Ukrainian people to choose their own future. And now they continue these things, but in year 2014, they choose European future. They choose, and now almost 65% support the Ukrainian membership in NATO, and 70% of Ukrainians support of Ukrainian membership in the European Union. We now fighting not only for our sovereignty and territorial integrity, we now fighting for their freedom, we now fighting for democracy, we now fighting for the democratic values.
Okay.
And under the Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, this is the sovereign right of Ukrainian state, of Ukrainian people for self-defense.
And that was former Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko speaking to us a short time ago. And you can get more detail on the background of this story on the BBC website. Still to come on NewsHour, the extraordinary story of how Thailand and Saudi Arabia fell out over diamonds and why they've now made up.
What we know is that a Thai cleaner working for a Saudi prince way back in 1989 managed to steal a large number of jewels and got them back to Thailand, didn't really know the value of them, started selling them to a jeweller who was very aware of their value. Now, among them was this 50-carat, very rare blue diamond of almost incalculable value. After that, things got messy.
More on that to come in about 25 minutes. And a quick reminder of another headline from the BBC newsroom this hour. The International Red Cross has delivered aid to the war-torn Ethiopian region of Tigray for the first time in 5 months. And we're hoping to get more on that story too later this hour. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. And here in London, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson remains under intense pressure as yet more accusations emerge of social gatherings at government buildings, including the official residence, 10 Downing Street, during the strictest COVID lockdowns over the past 2 years, the latest being for his birthday in June 2020. Well, as senior civil servant Sue Gray has been looking into at least 17 occasions that may have breached lockdown rules, and her report is expected imminently. Yesterday, the Metropolitan Police announced it was also investigating reports of possible illegal behaviour at the time. Well, in the past couple of hours, Mr Johnson has been facing a barrage of criticism in the lower house, the Commons, at the weekly session of Prime Minister's Questions. And here you can hear the leader of the opposition party, Sir Keir Starmer.
The Ministerial Code says that ministers who knowingly mislead Parliament will be expected to offer their resignation. Does the Prime Minister believe that applies to him?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, of course, but let me tell the House that I think he's inviting a question about an investigation which, as you know, Mr. Speaker, I can't comment, and which he, as a lawyer, Mr. Speaker, will know that I can't comment on. And what I am focused on is delivering the fastest recovery of any European economy from COVID.
And that was the way the Prime Minister answered many of the questions today. No comment. Well, I've been speaking to Matt Warman, who's the Conservative MP for Boston in Lincolnshire, a town in the UK Midlands.
So I think what you saw was a really punchy performance from the Prime Minister, determined to talk about things like the cost of living, things like the COVID recovery, things like what's going on in the Ukraine. Obviously, that is not what the Labour Party wants to talk about.
Well, yes, clearly Mr. Johnson is desperate to change the subject, isn't he? But we are expecting the findings of this report by the civil service, by Sue Gray, to come out imminently, perhaps even today. We're told that they probably will be published in full. They might contain video and photographs, which may include pictures of the Prime Minister himself. When that happens, it's going to be very difficult, isn't it, to continue to support him?
Well, I think the whole point of this investigation is to allow those facts to be established, and when that is released, then we can come to a decision both as a party, and individual MPs are obviously a hugely important part of that. But I think prejudging that is not terribly sensible, and it doesn't actually get us much further. What I do think, though, is definitely important is whatever is in that report, it is going to be important to tackle all of those issues that the Prime Minister was talking about at PMQs anyway.
Yeah, of course, you want to wait for the report to come out, but we've already heard from the police saying that they are investigating potential criminal offences that may have happened in the offices of the highest office in the land of the Prime Minister. They say they only would do this if the most serious and flagrant abuses seemed to come to light, that people ought to have known that what they were doing was against the rules. And surely people across the country who sacrificed so much, and people around the world can understand this, then to see their Prime Minister seeming to disregard those rules, it's a very difficult square to circle, isn't it, for you?
Well, it would be if that was a foregone conclusion. But I do think the whole point of the Prime Minister setting up the first civil service inquiry and the police looking at it as well is to establish those facts. And what you've just said is essentially the thrust of one of Keir Starmer's questions at PMQs. What he is clearly trying to do is to say this is all a foregone conclusion, that we want to prejudge all of it. I simply don't think it's right to do that. And let's have the conversation when all of those facts are established, rather than trying to skew the pitch in the first place.
He's sort of under siege at the moment, isn't he, Boris Johnson? There are many things that could topple him, and the press is circling around number 10 constantly. We know that it could take 54 letters from disgruntled Tory Conservative MPs to trigger a vote of no confidence in Mr. Johnson. If that were to happen, which way would you vote?
Well, I think I would be supporting the Prime Minister, and I think I'd be doing that primarily because you have to set his record in context, and all of that is around the economy, it's around the vaccine programme, it's around those big calls that he has genuinely got right. Now, I'm not pretending again for a second that some of my colleagues have not come out very publicly and said that they take a different view, but I do think that if you set that record in context, you do come to the conclusion that this is both a Prime Minister and a government that has made some really tough decisions and has ultimately got them right. We need to look at that context. But I do think, whether it's a high-risk strategy or not, it's for MPs to do what they think is right and to say, look at who was in charge when we got those big calls right. Is it sensible to continue to believe that in the future he will continue to get the big calls right? I do think that record is one not just to be proud of, but also to take forward into the future.
That was Conservative MP Matt Warman there, sticking by Boris Johnson for now. Well, Rob Watson is here. He's our UK political correspondent. You were watching Prime Minister's questions today, Rob. A lot of noisy support for the Prime Minister, but the opposition leader Keir Starmer did aim quite a few of his questions and criticisms at the Cabinet, the front bench, putting them under pressure to abandon Mr Johnson. Do you think they will?
I think the key thing that Keir Starmer was trying to do was to say, if Boris Johnson goes down, I think he's trying to make sure that it's all guilt by association, that the whole government is made to look rotten. I think you raise a really interesting question. And I guess what I'd point out and what makes Mr. Johnson's situation perhaps better for him is that most political deaths require an assassin, right? Tony Blair had Gordon Brown. Theresa May had Boris Johnson. David Cameron had Boris Johnson as well, and Margaret Thatcher had Michael Heseltine. Interestingly, in this cabinet, I mean, one doesn't know exactly how uncomfortable they feel defending some of this stuff, but there isn't an assassin, and that helps Johnson a lot.
Now, you've got your ear to the ground in Westminster. It's full of rumours at the moment. Any intel on what might be in this long-awaited report by Sue Gray?
Well, we've heard that there'll be WhatsApp messages that could be very embarrassing, and perhaps some photos of the Prime Minister near bottles of wine. I mean, goodness only knows. But I think one can assume, can't one, without any doubt, that obviously it's been some pretty serious stuff in this report, because that's why the police are investigating, because the person compiling the report has been in close touch with the police all along.
And you mentioned the police there. It's not the only investigation, is it? Because we've had these claims by Conservative MPs going to the police to report blackmail. That's also another story. But what do you envisage will happen out of that?
Do you know, the most interesting thing, and this ties all of these loose ends together, is the common thread is that Boris Johnson is a man who's going to fight with every kind of fibre in his body to keep his job as Prime Minister and as leader of the Conservative Party. I mean, that's what you get from Prime Minister's questions. That's what you kind of get take away from this idea of there's been a lot of strong-arm tactics against Conservative MPs, urging them not to kind of back a vote of no confidence against them. I mean, this is a man who is not going to give up without a fight.
Rob Watson, thank you very much. Watching every twist and turn in this story, and we'll drag you back in if anything happens in the next half an hour. Thank you, Rob. Stay tuned, lots more to come from NewsHour, live from the BBC World Service.
Keep up with the news from around the world, wherever in it you are.
Our correspondent in Washington,
in Beirut,
in Nairobi,
Pakistan,
Sumatra.
Profit from the noise of business and the economy.
Once you get to the top, it's just the hustle of being at the top.
Engineer away to find out about the latest tech.
It's just amazing what technology is out there already, but what is yet to come is very exciting.
Or let the technology in your pocket take you on an audio adventure.
Something strange has gone on.
Wow!
Just pure happiness.
It sounds beautiful.
Unbelievable.
Isn't that incredible?
From news and documentaries to science, history and culture. Whatever you want from a podcast, the BBC World Service has something for you.
Does that make us twice as intelligent?
Search for BBC World Service wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. A COVID outbreak has hit a crucial Australian relief ship, which was bound for tsunami-stricken Tonga. Authorities there have stressed the need for aid to be delivered in a contactless way to avoid bringing the virus onto the island, which until this point has been virus-free. Officials say 4/5 of the population have been affected by the tsunami and volcanic ashfall. Well, the BBC's Shaima Khalil has been speaking to Dr. Francis Vulivuli, who's a health and nutrition specialist with UNICEF.
The COVID-19 outbreak on the Australian Navy ship carrying aid to Tonga is a clear example of what the Tongan government is trying to avoid, and why so far much-needed supplies are allowed in, but aid workers are not. 23 personnel on board HMAS Adelaide have tested positive for COVID-19. And we heard from Australia's Defence Minister, Peter Dutton, who said that they're now in contact with the Tongan authorities about what to do next. He said the last thing we want is to bring COVID to Tonga. And it's either we stand off or we port and deliver the supplies and the aid. And there is a reason why the Tongan government is quite nervous about all of this. This is a country that has recorded only one case of COVID-19 since the beginning of the pandemic. And this is something that aid agencies understand. I've been speaking to a number of them, including a health and nutrition specialist at UNICEF. And she says that, yes, she understands that while there is a need to be on the ground to get a first-hand account of what is needed, the extent of the damage, what they can do when they're in country, but also why the Tongan government is so reluctant to risk having COVID in the country.
So for a vulnerable nation, the last thing we want to have is a double crisis where we are dealing with the aftermath of the volcanic eruption and the tsunami and COVID. So UNICEF Pacific has been working closely with the government of Tonga, and we have ensured that, you know, we are boosting the vaccination coverage rates in country.
And the government obviously is adamant that no COVID should enter. Given the size of the disaster, the need for help to go in, is it realistic that no people would go in?
It is quite a challenge to be providing this support remotely in the context of this disaster that happened. However, we have built on the platforms that during COVID we have been providing remote assistance, and this has kind of strengthened our support remotely, technical support.
Apart from COVID, what other health risks are you worried about from UNICEF's perspective that need dealing with?
So the priority concern remains access to safe and clean drinking water for the children and the families that they live in. The other concern that we have is the effects of the ash, inhaling the ash, the respiratory issues that may come with it, and skin issues. So UNICEF is providing wash kits, water purification tablets, and masks and gloves to protect them immediately while we ship other basic health and nutrition supplies, education supplies, also psychosocial support and technical support remotely.
Dr. Francis Vuli-Vuli of UNICEF speaking to the BBC's Shaima Khalil there. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC with me, Rebecca Kesby. And let's return to our top story now, the situation in Ukraine and how the international community has been reacting to the crisis. The United States has put 8,500 troops on high alert to deploy to Europe as NATO reinforces its eastern borders. President Joe Biden has said he would consider personal sanctions on Vladimir Putin himself if Russia invades Ukraine, and warned of enormous consequences if Russia made a move on the nation. His comments come as other Western leaders repeat warnings that Russia would pay a heavy price for any invasion. But does this persuade Russia to back off or provoke more hostility? Let's speak live now to Republican Congressman Steve Chabot. He sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee and joins us live. Thank you so much for coming on. How do you feel about the messages coming from the White House at the moment? Do you think President Biden has got the right tack on this?
Well, it's an extremely dangerous situation when you have an excess of 125,000 Russian troops on Ukraine's border. I do think of late the president is saying the right things and for the most part doing the right things. But unfortunately, I think it was really the projection of weakness by this administration that has added to the problems. For example, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the concessions that were made there with really nothing in return, the cyber attack on our colonial pipeline, in which case not much was done in response to that. And then I think really the debacle in Afghanistan sent out a message of weakness across the globe to the world's bad actors. And obviously, Putin is in that category, as is President Xi in China. And we're also concerned, for example, on what he may do with respect to Taiwan. But right now, we're focused on Ukraine. And I hope that President Biden has learned a lesson here and that he will project strength. Right now, I think he's doing and saying the right things. Let's hope that he continues to do that.
You say that he should be stronger. I mean, it was President Trump, wasn't it, that actually poured question on NATO itself as an alliance shortly before he came to power. In fact, I think he described NATO as obsolete before he became president. Didn't that damage the alliance of NATO and also possibly weaken its effect with Russia?
Well, with President Trump, I think you have to look at what he said and then what he actually did. I think what he was trying to do was to get our European allies in NATO's attention about their meeting their obligations and their responsibility. Our European allies had agreed to basically pay 2% of their budget towards their military expenditure so that they would be able to work with the U.S. to defend them, and they were not meeting that obligation. Some have come around as a result of that. So I think in so much as he was able to accomplish that, that's a good thing. But I think the United States and our NATO allies have to work together. We have to be strong. We have to stand up to Putin's bullying. He'll push and get away with just as much as we allow. So we need to work together to prevent war from happening here. And as President Reagan had talked about, and his policies were, we want to see peace through strength. If we're strong, there's much less chance that we're going to see military bullying across the globe. Right now, I think Putin has sensed weakness and division in our NATO alliance, too, and he's trying to take advantage of that.
Yeah, you mentioned the division within NATO. And of course, we've got these meetings going on today in Paris. The United States is there, Russia, Ukraine, and France and Germany. Are you hoping that anything may come out of that?
I certainly hope so. And I think that's a sign that we are working together. We need to come together on very strong sanctions as well. We have some initial sanctions, but I think we have to look much further beyond the sanctions we've already implemented. Some of those I think we should put into effect now to deter military action by Putin. And then some, of course, would be imposed if he actually acts. We also need to make sure that the Ukrainians have the military weaponry that they're going to need to resist an attack should Putin decide to take action. And we need to make sure that Germany in particular is working with us on that, because in some instances, they've made it more difficult to arm Ukraine than is probably helpful.
And what do you make of the proposed legislation by the Republican Michael McCaul on the also on the Foreign Affairs Committee with you, isn't he, saying that the U.S. would provide Ukraine with military and diplomatic support, but also that it would stop the Nord Stream 2 from being operational? Do you think that's the way that this should proceed?
Yes, I do. McCaul has been really a leader on this and has been speaking out for quite some time on making sure that we provide a united front and a credible military resistance if it comes to that. And part of that is sanctions. Part of it is having sufficient weaponry, not only in Ukraine's hands, but our other allies in the Baltic allies and in Poland and on down the line. Putin, he's a bully, and he takes advantage of weakness. We have to project a united front, a strong front, and we do that much better if the United States and our NATO allies are working together.
Sure, but by doing that and stopping the Nord Stream 2, it does rather leave Germany in a rather compromised position, doesn't it? And Germany already has taken a slightly different tack to other NATO countries and other Western allies by not sending arms to Ukraine, and that's angered some in Kyiv.
Well, unfortunately, Germany has allowed itself to become too dependent on Russia relative to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline in particular. And let's face it, I mean, some of these actions, their dependence on Russia, it's self-imposed, shutting down all their nuclear power plants, for example. So now to some degree, they and we are all paying a price for those actions.
Okay, very good to speak to you. Thank you so much for joining us live. That's Republican Congressman Steve Chabot there. He sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Now Let's move to a story that sounds almost too extraordinary to be true. It involves the theft of priceless jewels from a Saudi prince, a cleaner from Thailand, and several grisly murders. It's a story that goes back 30 years and led to a severing of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Thailand. Today we hear, though, that both sides have decided to finally resume diplomatic relations. But where did it all start? I've been speaking to our correspondent in Bangkok, Jonathan Head, who gave me all the colourful and dramatic details.
It is an extraordinary story, and I think all the more extraordinary that it's not been resolved in all this time. These are two countries which have had a lot to lose from having their diplomatic ties severed, and it says a lot, I think, about the state of Thai law enforcement and the kind of people who might be involved in this scandal, that the Thais have been unable to clear up what really happened. What we know is that a cleaner or janitor working for a Saudi prince, a top member of the Saudi royal family, way back in 1989 managed to steal a large number of jewels, we think about 30 kilos, and got them back to Thailand. Didn't really know the value of them. We knew they were valuable, wasn't sure what to do with them. Started selling them to a jeweler who was very aware of their value. Now, among them was this 50 carat, very rare blue diamond of almost incalculable value. And I think he certainly realized the value of them. After that, things got messy. The Saudis asked for them back. The Thai police said they'd got them back and they'd arrested the Thai cleaner. And a police delegation went to Saudi Arabia with the jewels. And the Saudis then said, well, most of the jewels hadn't come back and the ones that had were fake. Following that, there were a whole series of mysterious killings related to this case. And the Saudis were very unhappy. Three Saudi diplomats died and then a Saudi businessman. They were shot dead. And then a Saudi businessman who came out to investigate the jewellery heist went missing and has never been found since.
Goodness
there were also the jeweller's family were also involved. The jeweller's wife and 14-year-old son were kidnapped and murdered, and he himself was kidnapped. So it got very, very messy. Clearly, powerful people, almost certainly linked to the police, who were supposedly investigating the case, were trying to get their hands on the jewels. And the Saudis, because they were so unhappy about a lack of progress in the investigation, downgraded relations. Hundreds of thousands of Thai workers working in Saudi Arabia had to come back. And the relations have never recovered because every attempt by the Thais to find culprits or put people on trial have just become very messy and got nowhere.
Goodness. I mean, it really does sound like some kind of movie, doesn't it? I mean, it sounds fantastical in a way. And the worry, of course, these murders and the number of them, did any kind of legal ramifications come from any of that?
No, and that's what the Saudis were unhappy about. The policeman, who was a police general, a very senior policeman, who actually took the first lot of jewels back to Saudi Arabia, which then turned out to be largely fake, was eventually charged with the murder of the jewellery dealer, the man who'd got the jewels from the cleaner, with the murder of his wife and child. So he went to prison, although he was eventually pardoned. Everyone suspects he probably got his hands on some of the jewels, but that's not proven. But nobody knows where the blue diamond is. But three Saudi diplomats were murdered on the same night, back in early 1990. Now, other intelligence sources think that that may be completely unconnected, that it might actually be connected to Saudi relations with Iran, that it might have been an Iranian hit squad who took out those three diplomats. But the Saudis have always argued there is a link. And of course, this Saudi businessman who was sent to investigate the jewellery heist has clearly been murdered. He just disappeared. And although five policemen were charged with that, the case stopped and then it was revived again about a decade ago. And then they were eventually acquitted. So that case went on for many, many years. So no one has been brought to justice for the death of that Saudi businessman. And as far as the Saudis are concerned, it was unfinished business. But I think in the end, it's gone on so long. Both countries now have too much to gain to keep this thing going on. So I think finally, you know, more than 30 years after this scandal broke, both countries have decided that although this extraordinary story remains largely unresolved, they're ready to put it behind them.
Yes, and as you say, they've made this announcement that diplomatic relations will be resumed. What will that mean in practical terms, do you think?
Well, for the first time, we're going to have a full Saudi ambassador here. But following that, it's about the economic ties. You know, Saudi Arabia is a significant player, and it's a very important source of income for workers in this region. And trade ties are potentially very lucrative. So I think those will, you know, you'll see more Thai business people be looking for opportunities in Saudi Arabia. A whole load of good economic ramifications will come out of this. And I think both countries will be relieved they don't have to keep talking about this scandal.
And that was our correspondent in Bangkok, Jonathan Head, speaking to me a short time ago on that extraordinary story there from Thailand involving a Saudi prince and these jewels. They still don't know where that diamond, the blue diamond, is. Don't forget, if you can't listen to this programme live, you can always catch it on the podcast, which is available online. Twice a day, it's updated, it's completely free, and you can just go to where you get your podcasts and do a search for BBC NewsHour. And a reminder of our top story this hour. Ukraine's foreign minister has played down fears that a Russian invasion may be imminent, saying Moscow has not yet massed enough forces. But earlier, Ukraine's former president, Petro Poroshenko, told this programme that the crisis in Ukraine posed a very serious threat to Europe.
Nobody has any illusion that this is the danger for the European and global security, because Putin can at the same time attack to the Baltic states, attack to the Poland, using Ukraine as an instrument for blackmailing the whole world.
And one other headline this hour, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has insisted he won't resign as he awaits reports on the party held at Downing Street during coronavirus lockdown. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London with me, Rebecca Kesby. Now, the environmental group Greenpeace has estimated that at least 100,000 empty or ghost flights could be flown across Europe this winter because of EU airport rules that require airlines to use their allocated takeoff and landing slots or lose them. They say that would generate up to 2.1 million tonnes of greenhouse gas emissions, which is as much as 1.4 million cars emit each year. Stefan de Keersmaeker is the EU Commissioner's spokesperson on transport. I asked him, how does he respond to these criticisms?
We, of course, totally agree that empty flights or ghost flights are bad for our economy and they're bad for our environment. But that's exactly why the European Commission has taken measures from the start of the pandemic 2 years ago to exactly avoid these kind of empty flights. In normal times, an airline must use 80% of its slots to keep it for the next season. We reduced it for the current winter season to 50%. By the way, at the beginning of the pandemic, we reduced to 0%. But now, for this winter season, 50%.
You're back up to 50%, and then you're saying that it could rise again in March to 64%. And it's not just environmental groups that are calling for a change in policy. It's the airlines themselves. I mean, it's hard to think of an industry that's not been worse hit by the pandemic than airline.
This system has worked very well for 2 years and has always been very much welcomed by airports, airlines, and so on. We acknowledge that because of the pandemic, there's less flights, which is why we reduce the percentage. You should know that for the current winter season, we are already at 75% of traffic that we had in 2019. So our minimum use of 50% is very reasonable. But also very important is that we use what's called a justified non-use exemption. So in addition to this reduced slot usage, airlines can request not to use the slot at all if, for instance, because of the pandemic, all kinds of sanitary measures are taken, which makes these flights difficult. And this is an exemption that has been used by all airlines. And so we have these measures which have been established exactly to avoid empty flights. So if an empty flight is in the air, it is not because of European rules, it's because of a commercial decision taken by the airline company.
But this idea that you have to use these slots or lose them, from the Green perspective, this seems to go in contrast to the EU vision of a more environmental way forward, doesn't it?
Of course, the Green Deal is absolutely fundamental, and that was one of the reasons why we came up with these measures. There is absolutely no need to keep empty flights in the air, and we have the justified non-use, so airlines can request not to use the slots. Let's also not forget that slots are a public good. It allows connectivity between airports. So if an airline does not use it, then in theory, the slot use can be granted to another airline following a competitive procedure.
But of course, people that work for Greenpeace and other environmental groups are pointing to this and saying actually ghost flights really are a symbol of the failed aviation system that's been needing some sort of overhaul for years.
The first thing I would like to say is that we have not yet seen any evidence of empty flights. That's one thing. Second, we are allies in the fight for a good Green Deal. We do not want empty flights in the air. Third, in the context of our Green Deal, we are taking several measures also in the air, for instance, the use of sustainable aviation fuels and other measures to help greening the transport sector and in particular the aviation sector, because this is indeed extremely important priority for us.
And that was Stefan de Keersmaeker there, the EU Commissioner's spokesperson on transport. Now, the International Committee of the Red Cross says that for the first time in 5 months, it has been able to deliver medical aid to the war-hit northern Ethiopian region of Tigray. The flight landed in the capital, regional capital, Mekelle, just a couple of hours ago. Earlier this month, you may remember on NewsHour that we spoke to a hospital doctor there who told us that vital medication and supplies were running out fast. At the same time, there's a widespread, severe malnutrition emergency as food convoys have also been unable to get through. Let's get an assessment of the situation now with Alona Sineko, who is the ICRC's regional spokesperson based in Nairobi. Alona, thank you very much for coming on the programme. First of all, just tell us what you managed to get in there today on this flight.
Hello. So, yes, today it was a huge relief for all of us that we managed to deliver the first shipment out of a series of shipments that we are planning to carry out throughout this week and beyond this week. We managed to bring essential surgical supplies and some essential drugs. The supplies that we brought today should be sufficient.
It's very difficult to hear you. Perhaps if you just...
Oh, that's... Hello?
Yes, please carry on.
Okay, so the supply that we brought in today should be sufficient to treat approximately 200 injured people, but we are hoping, and it's also essential and crucial, that this assistance continues throughout the week and that we bring more supplies.
And have you had assurances that the security situation for your personnel on the ground, that they will be able to get about and get that aid in without difficulty?
We have a constructive dialogue with the authority, and it is thanks to this constructive dialogue that we actually managed to bring this first cargo into Mekelle today. So we hope that this dialogue will continue and that this crucial and necessary assistance will continue arriving to Tigray throughout this week and in the future.
Okay, so we've been talking about medical supplies, but we also know that the situation with food security is also very urgent there. What are your workers on the ground able to tell you about the situation and what's happening with some of those aid convoys?
The situation, the food situation on the ground is very difficult indeed, and we have been talking about it for quite some time now, and we've been also responding to the food situation for some time, distributing seeds and tools to farmers so that they can plant their crops, and also distributing food assistance to hospitals. And of course, more needs to be done. And again, we are very happy and we welcome the opening and the dialogue that we're having with the authorities on the humanitarian needs. And we hope that more essential supplies will be delivered to the people who need them most.
Okay, well, do please keep us updated with the situation as your workers on the ground there find it. Thank you so much for joining us live there. That's Alona Sineko on the line from Nairobi. And sorry for the poor quality of that line in places, but I think we managed to hear most of what she said.
NewsHour has been a download from the BBC. To discover more and our terms of use, visit bbc.com/podcasts.